Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
And in surfing, it's you know, one person's great wave is another person's nightmare. You know, it very much depends. You know, what you want very much depends on what you can handle, how well you surf, how well you absorb punishment, what your sort of threshold of fear and kind of desire are, because the kind of thing you're driving toward, if you, you know, chase waves in a serious way, is that wave or the sort of wave that puts you right up against your limits, and so that you're in something that's really challenging, perhaps even, you know, terrifying, and yet you do have the ability and the steadiness to ride it well and get right close to the thing you're sort of most afraid of, you know, the powerful wave, you know, driving you into the bottom sort of thing, and yet not have that happen or have the experience of just skidding by and making it, you know, with all the kind of adrenaline that entails. And what it really is this kind of, at that moment, this drenching experience of beauty, and that's what you're after. And it's not even the danger quotient that you know, you push to the limit. It's more the sort of intensity of that, of the beauty that when you are near those limits and inside that kind of wave.
Do surfers have perfect fetish? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Waves are better than anything in books, better than movies, better even than a ride at Disneyland. Because with them, the charge of water was uncontrived. It was real, and you could learn to manoeuvre around them, how long to wait on the bottom, how to swim outside beyond the break, and eventually how to body surf. So writes journalist, author, and legendary surfer William Finnegan in his awe-inspiring memoir, Barbarian Days, which won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Biography. Well, tonight in Talking Books, we're going to travel from California to Sri Lanka to Fiji, Australia, South Africa, and further afield, chasing waves with William Finnegan, and unpack whether surfing is a sport or a spiritual practice.
Hello, my name is William Finnegan. I'm an American writer. I've recently written a memoir called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life, but I've written a number of journalistic books also about war and poverty. I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. I've been here since 1987, so do a lot of international reporting and conflict reporting.
William, what a charming and interesting life. You've really gone for it in so many different ways. I might throw you a big wide open question to start off with. You describe surfing as a secret garden not easily entered, and talk a lot about terror and enchantment and obsession and all the complexities that brings up. I'm just wondering, is it fair to describe surfing as a state of being in the world, that it's a path of sorts, it's a choice, it's a life decision?
Yeah, I think that's all fair. I mean, it can be overblown, but there is this way in which surfing is not like other things. I mean, it's really not like a sport. It's something you need to put generally many years into and start quite young to be able to enter into it, to be able to do it halfway competently and forget about the sort of basics of, you know, catching waves and standing up and proceed toward the waves and what you really want to be doing and into more serious surfing. And I've spent this ridiculous number of years chasing waves all over the world, and people I've done it with are as much a part of the story, certainly, as the surfing itself. And you do feel like you've entered this world that's not easily seen by anybody else. I mean, what its terms are and what it is you're chasing. It's not obvious at all at a glance from, you know, the to the uninitiated. And so the book tries to bring readers inside there and sort of show how you get there and what it's like on the inside of this thing that superficially looks like, you know, fun in the sun, but in fact is full of many more emotions and a much sort of more rigorous, I don't know if I'd call it consequential. I mean, after all, it's a hobby, but it's a sort of darker and more and richer world than it appears at a glance, and more demanding intellectually, believe it or not.
William, you've lived and breathed through waves and on waves and in waves for a lot of your life. I'm just wondering, is there such a thing as the perfect wave? Does that actually exist?
I would say no. I mean, it's a stock phrase. You know, it's been a cliche forever, and in fact was really popularized, I think, by this documentary film you may or may not remember from the 60s called Endless Summer. It was a sort of crossover hit, one of the very few artifacts from the world of surfing, you know, books, magazines, movies that crossed over and that non-surfing audiences could appreciate. And it was the story of a couple of guys who travel around the world, as I say, this is the mid-60s, looking for the perfect wave. And it was funny how that movie, I mean, it had a huge impact on me. I was just a kid, and all my friends, I mean, it really sort of warped our career goals at the age of, you know, 10. This is what I want to do. When I grow up, I want to travel around the world, you know. And I ended up actually doing that in my 20s when I finished my studies. I set off and spent nearly 4 years circling the globe, you know, working odd jobs and chasing waves, trying to find waves that nobody had surfed. And the irony of that is the real thing, the Endless Summer, was just kind of a 6 week film shoot. The two guys were great surfers of the day, Mike Hinson and Robert August, California, and the filmmaker Bruce Brown basically hired them. You know, he had an idea and let's do this, and they did a 6 week shoot and called it a movie. And then a whole impressionable generation, including me, thought this was life and this is what you had to do with your life when you grew up as a surfer. So, but the idea of the perfect wave, and they find it in South Africa in the movie, and it's all kind of hokey and contrived. I mean, they didn't really find it as they claim in the movie, and they didn't, and it doesn't break so great, you know, year-round, as they claim. I mean, it's really sort of trumped up, so to speak. And the reason I say no to the idea of a perfect wave, I guess, is because waves are such, they're not like some stationary object in nature. You know, it's not a diamond or a rose, something you can contemplate. It's this kind of quick, violent moment in the ocean at the end of a long chain of other forces, you know, the storm that creates the wave and sends it, and then as it, you know, feels the bottom and starts to break, and I mean, it's another great cliche, but no two waves are the same. I mean, there are great waves, and that's said from the surfer's point of view, a great, great wave. But the idea of perfection as this kind of achieved and static thing it doesn't really apply at all to what surfing is.
I was very interested in what you wrote in terms of how you're on a wave, and there's this violence and then there's this beauty and how you capture that beauty, but also I think you describe it as the fear line. Can you talk me through all of this? I think somewhere you say that the surf was your refuge, your happy hiding place, but it was also a hostile wilderness, a dynamic, indifferent world. It's your enemy, it's your friend, it's the beauty, it's the drive, it's so many different things. But there is the dark side creeping up as you practice through the wave, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that passage is from quite early on in the book where I'm trying to account for, you know, learning to surf. That was, I grew up in California, but we moved to Hawaii when I was 13. My dad got a job over there, and I've been surfing for a few years, and it was just this dream come true. And and we lived quite near the beach, and so I was surfed constantly in more challenging, exciting waves, and it was really great. But it was in my sort of description of, you know, learning to surf in those years. I tried to draw this distinction between surfing and other things one might do, other sports, where there's always, especially when waves get a little bigger, there's always this fear line, as you mentioned, that you have to reckon with what you can handle. You know, the waves are now getting bigger, they're getting more powerful. You know, can I go out there? Can I go over there where it's really concentrating its power, and the more exciting waves are there, but can I handle it? Or, you know, worst case, will I drown? So that's always there. And you know, as you get older, you get stronger, you get more competent, it moves back. It moves back. What was scary last year is manageable this year. But that factor, that aspect of surfing is really distinguishes it. I mean, I don't think that kids, you know, heading out to the rugby field worry, you know, gee, I might die today. But that's there, that kind of shadow. As I say, not every day, smaller days not, but as the waves get better and the waves get more powerful, it's a constant consideration. And so it was this very mixed, I was writing, I think, in that passage also about just, I'd been confirmed, I was raised Roman Catholic, and then given by my parents the freedom to decide, you know, you're now an adult in the eyes of the church, you don't have to go to Mass if you don't want to. I couldn't believe that when I heard it, and promptly said, okay, then I won't. And then felt quite sort of adrift. You know, my family was the oldest kid. They're still going to Mass, and I've got my Sundays free. And, of course, spent all that time in the water. And the kind of ways I felt adrift and like I had perhaps, you know, to overblow it slightly, to like I joined some other church, this sort of pagan form of worship out in the ocean, and these sort of existential questions are around you all the time.
Do you think it's possible, though, when you love something so much and you've got huge drive and passion, that some days our judgments, maybe our judgment call, it can change? And do you think it's a given that on any given day that we can know what our limits are on the water? Now, I'm asking you this as a sailor. I'm just wondering that we have very good days and we have very bad days, and we can make brilliant judgment calls, and then it can all fall apart.
Yeah, that's, of course, the great unknown, as you judge your abilities. Can I handle this, both as a kid and in one's maturity, and then now for me in one's declining powers. I'm in my 60s now, and I don't surf as well as I used to. I still have, you know, I know as much as I did. My judgment is not impaired. I think, oh, I can do that, but can I really? You know, as I say, the waves get more serious. But from childhood, making those judgments, I think I can handle this. But of course, you don't know what's going to develop, how critical the situation may become, and a lot of the stories I tell in this book, what happens is, you know, the unexpected. You know, suddenly your board snaps, or the waves get bigger, or you know, a huge current develops that wasn't there before, and your plans all come unstuck, and as you say, the brilliant day can quickly turn into a nightmare.
You describe the surfing scene, whether it's in Australia, Sri Lanka, Hawaii, California. The memoir visits so many different interesting locations, but you describe it all as very esoteric or subcultural, obsessive, not mainstream. I'm just wondering how much of that has changed.
I think, you know, the popularity of surfing has just increased exponentially over the 50 years I've been doing it, and it's kind of awful. That is to say, the good and well-known and easily accessible surf spots get more and more crowded. You see this in Ireland as well as, you know, other countries, certainly the U.S. and East Coast, West Coast, Hawaii, Australia, where I lived for a while and recently visited a couple of times. The crowding factor is just as constant. I mean, driving surfers to travel more and more to try to find less crowded ways. So people who surf are not really except for people maybe in the industry selling something to do with surfing, surfers are generally not happy with increased popularity of surfing. I see that surfing will now be included in the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo, which is not happy news for me and a lot of surfers who think like me, because the sort of mainstreaming of surfing, the idea that sort of anybody can do it and everybody will, I mean, it's not that so many people will become serious surfers, because it's such a commitment of time and more than that, it's you have to really kind of submerge in it to become somebody who's going to be surfing serious waves and competing for those scarce resources. Still, the sort of mass popularity is, I don't know, makes me uncomfortable. I find myself in conversations with people telling me they're going to take up surfing, you know, on their next vacation sort of thing, because you see it all around you in commercial settings, you know, everything being sold with surfing imagery and an increasingly kind of healthy mainstream kind of sport framework around surfing, but that really barely fits. I mean, most surfers have nothing to do with competition you can go your whole life surfing and never even see a contest. You know, the formalized competitive part of surfing is really way over at the margins of the thing itself. But it's changed a lot from being relatively obscure and subcultural to being kind of right in the center of especially youth culture.
You talk a lot about wave judgment and reading the waves, and what I find really interesting is, and whether it's you're a sailor, you're a swimmer, you're a fisherman, whatever you're doing on the water, you know, there's swell size, wind speed, wind direction, all of that stuff. In your case, you're dealing a lot with sandbars and stuff like that, but a lot of the deciding factors and staying on your surfboard are actually non-oceanic. So it's your mood, your state of presence, your muscles, and how you deploy them, I suppose.
It's true. There's this combination of this, the athleticism of surfing and having that all together and doing what you need to do to surf well. But then there's the judgment, the sort of ocean judgment. That's the kind of less appreciated part in a way. Anybody can watch a surf video and say, oh, look at the wonderful things that guy is doing. But if you surf and you have, you know, some reasonable competence, that part of it is only sort of semi-conscious. The real concentration is on, as you say, you know, swell direction and the tide and how currents are pulling across the bottom and the sort of patterns of sets, as we call them, when a group of waves come, what angle will they come at, where exactly will they break, and where do you need to be. Study, this very, very close study. I mean, most people have a local spot, you know, a place they mainly surf or a group of places around near where they live, and they are locals trying to get those spots wired, as we say. And that work is of over years and is so, I mean, the quality of attention is so acute. And again, not something obvious, you know, at a glance to someone passing by, but the people you see out there in the water are really, really very close students of a very small patch of coast, and in all conditions, you know, year-round and every wind condition. And they're all trying to basically to understand and to predict what the ocean is going to do next, and then to, you know, sort of be in the right place doing the right thing for what's going to happen next. And it's this constant puzzle, this constant, you know, like struggle to guess and to get it right, and that's a lot of what's going on out in the water.
So much concentration. You describe a swell as one of God's jazz solos. I thought that was brilliant. I just got me thinking, how much of surf science is beyond our understanding? Do you think we can know it all?
No, we can't. I think that passage was trying to get at the limits of how much you can understand. Because there are all these patterns, and surfers are constantly discussing, oh, this is like, you know, that other southwest swell we got last year, you know, after the storm that, you know, and sort of trying to place things in an analytic context. And so, you know, with this wave interval, you know, that's the number of seconds between the waves passing a fixed point, which is a kind of crucial bit of understanding what's going on with waves, and all these other variables you're trying to sort of feed into your understanding of what you're looking at and what you ought to be doing while you're surfing. Then there's everything beyond that little grid that you can set up to help you and that you can't possibly predict and need to deal with as it appears. So there's plenty of luck factors into it there, and the limitations of your ability to understand what the ocean is doing are constantly being sort of reinforced and you're constantly being reminded of them.
It's a bit like humanity and people. You're always wondering what they're up to. What are they doing, aren't you? And certainly as a journalist, I'm sure that's taken you in some very interesting directions. Can you describe Fiji in 1978? I loved reading about all the planning that you did, getting to, have I pronounced this correctly, Tararua Island, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you describe it? Because I'd say a lot has changed now since 78, because obviously lots of hotels, you've got water systems in there now. When you were there, you had to go over on a boat holding all your water, didn't you?
Yeah, that was sort of a high point in that long trip I mentioned. That a friend and I started in 78, and we were in the South Pacific, in Tonga and Samoa and Fiji and, you know, island groups looking for waves in odd places where surfers hadn't been before. People had never seen a surfboard. And we just had, this was, you know, long before the internet, of course, and Google Earth and all that good stuff. So we just had navigational maps, you know, that we'd carry with us and study very closely, trying to figure out where there might be good waves and where the prevailing trade winds might strike those waves at the angle you hope for with surfing. And we'd found some pretty good waves and often, you know, been fooled. Places we thought would be great didn't have anything, or had, you know, rocks that didn't appear on the charts, or it was this long, slow process of learning what's actually there as opposed to what's on the maps. But then, Tararua in West Fiji was probably the greatest discovery of my surfing life. It was a tiny, uninhabited island off Viti Levu, the main island in Fiji. And we weren't the very first guys to surf there. We'd overheard on marine radio on a yacht a little sort of crackling reference to a perfect 300-yard left. Which is a phrase to prick up any surfer's ears. And so we'd had a notion that somebody had found some great wave out there. And eventually we ran across one of the guys in a little town called Lautoka and got him to tell us where they had been. So there'd been a couple of people who'd found this wave off a sailboat. We didn't have a boat. We were just, you know, backpacking with surfboards. And so we got some fishermen from a village across the way, across the channel, to take us out there and just camped. And there was no fresh water on the island. It was a tiny place. But the setup was fairly fickle. It was a long, there were some many days without waves. It was inconsistent. But when the swells came, the waves wrapped, as we say, around the island, something like 180 degrees, right back into the trade wind, and then peeled down a coral reef with the most incredible precision. It was a really, really beautiful wave. And so we camped there for many weeks, and each week the fishermen were supposed to come back, bring us fresh water and more supplies. Sometimes we'd go with them for the night over back to the big island and get stuff ourselves. But basically we just waited on it, and it was a real, real high point, that wave. And a couple of other yachts with surfers stopped in that year, and we all had this kind of, you know, blood oath to never tell anybody where this was. You know, surfing is like that. You find a great spot and want to keep the secret. But somebody didn't keep the secret, and while I was, you know, planning to go back there, you know, one day soon, you know, several years later, I opened a surf magazine, and there it was. And not only had it been found, but a couple of Americans leased the island and built a hotel there, and the first surf resort was launched, and at our wonderful Secret Wave.
You describe the waves in Fiji, though, as having a thousand moods. And throughout the book, there's some classic lines. I have to hand you in that one. And you say that greatness is relative. Because I presume how Brian, your partner that you went with over to Fiji, I think the two of you have done a lot of travel together. It seems like an extraordinary friendship. That how Brian would perceive greatness and how you would, or whoever visited Tavarua Island, that it's all means something to so many different people. I think that you say that in Hawaii, the waves would have to get past 8 feet before anyone would kind of turn another eye at them. Whereas in other places, they're describing waves as cathedrals or something. So can you talk me through that?
I think that's a discussion of some of the kind of macho nonsense around wave size. Surfers are notoriously unwilling to describe waves as the size they actually are. How to figure it? Oh, this wave is 4 feet and that wave is 8 feet. It's a very inexact thing. I mean, it's are you measuring from where to where at what point? With surfers and my wave was bigger than yours sort of thing. It gets really ridiculous and Hawaii is well known for, Hawaii gets big waves. There's no continental shelf, and in the northern winter, the north coasts of the islands get fantastic, huge waves. And so Hawaiians are famous for saying that, it was, 8 feet today when the faces of the waves are clearly 20, 25 feet high, and it's terrifying, but it's mas macho. It's a more manly to downplay and say, it was 6 feet, it was 8 feet, when everybody else is terrified and calling it 20 or 30. So each place, and I now live in New York, and people around here, there's actually pretty good surf near New York on Long Island in New Jersey, so I'm sort of part of the surf culture here, and it's completely different, wave measurement system. 6 feet here would be, 2 feet in Hawaii. So there's just that. And
kind of a bit like sex, the way people talk it up. And then there's some gross underestimations, and then there's absolute total bullshit. But it all comes down to, what is that beautiful moment? I've done some sailing where it's been really rough and physical and hard, and you love it. And then there's other calm times, and how you measure beauty on the water and on any different day. So it is all relative, really, isn't it?
It does. And in surfing, it's one person's great wave is another person's nightmare. It very much depends. What you want very much depends on what you can handle, how well you surf, how well you absorb punishment, what your sort of threshold of fear and kind of desire are. Because the kind of thing you're driving toward, if you chase waves in a serious way, is that wave or that sort of wave that puts you right up against your limits, and so that you're in something that's really challenging, perhaps even terrifying, and yet you do have the ability and the steadiness to ride it well and get right close to the thing you're sort of most afraid of, the powerful wave, driving you into the bottom sort of thing, and yet not have that happen or have the experience of just skidding by and making it, with all the kind of adrenaline that entails. And what it really is this kind of, at that moment, this drenching experience of beauty, and that's what you're after. And it's not even the danger quotient that you push to the limit. It's more the sort of intensity of that, of the beauty that when you are near those limits and inside that kind of wave.
When I was reading about a surf friend of yours, Mark, I think you call him Doc, he's such a fascinating guy. And how you describe him as a man who has enormous sense of freedom on the waves and how he understands it all. And it got me thinking, Do you think it can be very normal in your everyday life, in your working life, in your social, sexual, whatever types of lives you want to describe it as? And then when you get on the water, you can have a death wish, which can be slightly psychotic, to put it mildly. Do you think that can coexist?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, Mark was a conundrum that way. He was a big wave surfer, which is a sort of separate breed. There's every surfer sort of has his or her limits and size waves they're willing to venture among. And then there are these big wave surfers who are a quantum leap away. I mean, they places where any sane person would be heading for the channel, heading for the horizon, heading for safety. It's just too terrifying. They are moving toward it. You know, it's like they're made of different stuff. I'm not a big wave surfer, but Mark is, and I spent a few years with him in San Francisco surfing a place called Ocean Beach, which is can get really big and is generally quite intimidating. And he was always urging me to, you know, borrow my big wave board, and you know, you can ride the 8.8, which is like a board I would never own, and come out with me on these giant days. So I was kind of up against that with him, and right there, ringside seat with somebody who was really pushing it, who would go out in terrifying conditions alone, usually, and you know, come back in one piece. And he's a doctor, a family practice physician, but with a specialty in cancer education. And so he spent a lot of time, you know, considering sort of life and death questions and his work and working with people who were really up against it. And I try to tease out some of the relationships there. I mean, he also had fairly severe asthma. So he was really familiar as sort of as a doctor and scientifically competent to describe what it is to be out of breath and then more out of breath and then truly, I think cyanotic is the term, I mean really in trouble. And these things all come into play in bigger ways, of course, when you're held underwater for a long time. And so he had a kind of cool and scientific take on a lot of the danger out in big waves. And I tried to tease out some of that in the way he'd talk about it, and the way he'd sort of control his nerves where most people would be in a complete panic.
Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, tonight I'm talking with journalist, author and surfer William Finnegan, whose memoir Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life has just been published by Little Brown, where William writes, surfing had, and has, a steel thread of violence running through it. I asked William about his own relationship with this mysterious steel thread, and about some of the mind-blowing waves he surfed in Madeira.
Yeah, there were. Madeira, like Hawaii, sits out way out in the Atlantic. Like Hawaii, it has no continental shelf, so it's exposed to storms from the North Atlantic that just come in unimpeded, and it gets really huge and doesn't have any outer reefs as Hawaii does that sort of break up the power, so they come. Waves come in quite close and quite huge, and there's no beaches there. It's very very steep, beautiful island, and so you're surfing off cliffs, generally very rocky shores, and often with really powerful waves. So it never really got crowded, and I started started going there in the 90s and went there for sort of winter after winter, and it was a kind of that was as close as I've come to. I had to get a sort of specialized big wave board for some of the places there, and was really up against my limit often there, and also very happy. It's a kind of lonely and strange part of Portugal, and the village I used to stay in, I'd rent a room for $8 a night in a house, and would work. I'd take work and be writing when the waves weren't good, and surfing whenever they were. The number of winters just before my daughter was born, and when she came along in 2001, I stopped going. But it is a very, very sort of spooky and wondrous place, Madeira, I think.
It's funny how our bodies change as we get older and some of the unexpected stuff that happens. But I imagine when your big passion is life, is how you use your body in terms of on a surfboard, whether it's your muscles, your strength, your quickness, your agility in all sorts, mentally, emotionally, physically, in all sorts of different ways. How have you worked through all of that? Because my body at 20 compared to now at 42, there's a lot of things I can do now better than I did at 20, but there's a hell of a lot of stuff that I did at 20 that I can't do now. So, and some of that stuff I really liked. So what's that like, and how have you worked through all of that? Like, obviously you've a beautiful daughter and a wife, and that adds on certain responsibilities, but listening to your body and how it ages and how it, you know, the kind of the quirks within your own body, you're forced to do that with age, aren't you? You can't just brutally go through it and park it in any way.
No, you can't. I mean, it's, in a word, it's horrible. You know, you just as a surfer, you at some point, I don't know, in your 20s, your 30s, you start this long decline, you know, back to a beginning surfer's sort of universally referred to as a kook, and you're sort of heading back toward, you're becoming a kook again. It's horrible. In some ways, it gets worse every year. I mean, you get cagey and you change equipment. You get slightly easier boards to surf, and you're, you know, more crafty about which waves you go on and all that sort of thing. But this problem of you have the same judgment you've always had, and in fact, if anything, your judgment might be a bit better. But whether you can act on that, whether you have the strength and quickness to get where you need to be and to jump up and you're just not going to surf as well as you used to. And you have to continually adjust for that and expect to get where you might once have, you know, pulled something off, some difficult maneuver, some trick, some wave that is sketchy. Now you probably won't, and you've got to be prepared for that unhappy circumstance. Getting old and surfing. I mean, I know surfers who are sort of doing it gracefully. They're changing equipment, getting bigger boards, and not frustrated by the fact that they can't surf as well as they did when they were young. And I look to them and think, I've got to adopt that attitude and stop kind of, you know, raging at the limits. And every year I plan to do that, but I haven't done it yet.
You talk about the psychic hole of quitting. I think we're all in some way, no matter what we're doing, whether it's musicians, artists, writers, whatever you're doing, you quit in different ways. But we're all facing that, aren't we? That there is an end point.
Yeah.
It's all improbable in some way.
Yeah, I think I continue to sort of live in denial and chase serious waves that I should perhaps be leaving to younger surfers, but I'm just not ready, and it gets more and more conscious, you know, the sort of what am I doing out here? Oh, I don't want to be anywhere else. I should mention, we were talking about Madeira, sort of big waves in the Atlantic, that Ireland gets some amazing waves. I've never surfed them. I've only, you know, seen photos and video. But off the west coast, there are some really big, powerful, beautiful waves. Some of them so critical when it's big that people pretty much seem only to surf them with jet skis assisting them, kind of whipping them into the waves, kind of specialized big wave other places where people are still paddling in, and that Ireland's quite a hot spot for big wave surfing now, more so than Madeira is.
I was really interested in what you wrote about these great waves. I think you were talking about Kira at one stage, and they vanish. And you say surf spots are created and destroyed both naturally and by human enterprise. It's hard to square up which is worse, isn't it? Like, there's no answers to either. It's not easy on either side, sure, it's not.
Yeah, no, it's funny. As a surfer with your sort of sense of the coast where you grow up and learn to surf, these places, I grew up in Los Angeles and outside Los Angeles, and the Malibu, Rincon, these sort of famous waves, are such fixed points in your universe, you can't imagine that they would ever not be there. But suddenly, you know, a big rainstorm, a big flood, you know, an estuary bursts and the whole stretch of coast has changed, possibly forever or certainly for a few years, and mud fills in and Malibu disappears. I find these kind of things incredibly disorienting and upsetting, because, you know, the coast is the coast, but it's always changing. And I do write about several places that were great and then were gone, either from a storm or in one case an earthquake in Indonesia, a big earthquake, tsunami, completely changed a great wave, actually improved that wave. But other places, there was a great wave in Madeira called Jardim do Mar, which was destroyed by a seawall that the government built for no good reason whatsoever, just to kind of boondoggle for local contractors. The wave Kira you mentioned was one of the great waves in the world. This is in southern Queensland, Australia, and they changed a dredging scheme at a nearby river mouth, and suddenly all the sand filled in and Kira was gone. Surf spots, as you say, come and go.
I was trying to describe barbarian days to my friend Louise this morning, and I was saying, oh, you know, such interesting locations all over the world. It's a brilliant travelogue. And I was saying, well, really, it's a memoir, but it's really a book about choice. And then I said, well, it's love, it's agency. And so I was then cycling into this interview and thinking things through. It's really about going for it, really, this book, isn't it? It's a story about going for it.
I think that's a fair kind of summary, because surfing ends up being that, you know, in the tribe. I write about my life more generally, not a great deal about my work, but that's, you know, especially as I get into the sort of chapters of my adulthood, moved to New York and I'm working full time as a journalist, and surfing's kind of around the edges of that. You feel all the tension between those two things, and surfing and family and other, you know, sort of obligations of citizenship. I shouldn't put it that way, but I mean that's a fundamental tension in the book between citizenship in the sort of ancient sense of the word and this other life it informs the title, you know, Barbarian Days. What surfing ends up being in my bipolar life ends up being sort of the North Pole of irresponsibility, because the book's a lot about this kind of struggle to become a responsible citizen, but also the struggle against responsibility. And surfing ends up being this avenue in which, despite advancing age and all kinds of reasons for caution, I keep, as you put it, going for it. It's the call of you know, an even greater wave, an even more exhilarating experience of, as I say, beauty is so strong.
Well, I suppose you have to be responsible to your own truth or authenticity, and whether that is being an upstanding citizen or rights, livelihood or whatever, you're also, as your own truth can be, getting on that surfboard and navigating those waves and understanding them. I just was curious. You have reported from Sudan, Mozambique. You've written two books about South Africa. You've been as a foreign correspondent for The New Yorker into a lot of very tricky hotspots, whether it's post-conflict, during conflict. There's a lot, you've witnessed a lot, yet you have also been able to get on the surfboard. So you could have been in South Africa and, you know, tricky stuff going on, but then you can go into this meditative calm and balance on a surfboard. How do you do that?
I do sometimes get to sort of combine, you know, like take a break on a reporting trip in Costa Rica. I did that in Madagascar recently. I've, you know, now and again find good waves and actually can take a break. And it's sometimes it's the contrast, the difference between the two worlds, say. I mean, I remember once, most dramatically, I was covering the war in El Salvador. It's the civil war, you know, that ended in the early 90s, and had a really terrible day. Several journalists were killed that day, and so I filed my story from there. I usually write long pieces, come home and write them. I just got home from Venezuela, and I'm doing one of those now. But this El Salvador piece, I did a quick one from Salvador and sent it in, and then to kind of hide out and lick my wounds from that day, I went down to the surf spot, that this great wave that at the time was kind of empty because of the war, and just surfed. And the contrast between what one is doing, working, doing the kind of work I do, the kind of journalism, and what you're exposed to in the way of horror and you know, man's inhumanity to man, and then what the feelings are, what you're doing in the water, kind of taking nothing, you know, hurting no one, just trying to get close to what waves allow. That's, you know, really nourishing under the kind of horrendous circumstances of, well, a lot of the subjects I cover, humanitarian crises and wars. And I actually really wished I could take a break just these last few weeks in Venezuela, which has coast and some waves, but the security situation was so bad that, and they're not even having a war, it's just street crime and kidnapping. Was so bad that I actually couldn't justify or see my way clear to going down to the beach and taking a break.
I'm just wondering, when you were mapping out the memoir, and you obviously had to revisit a lot of friendships, you had some terrific girlfriends, I might add, throughout. There were some amazing women that you met and had relationships with. You have had, your parents are unbelievable in how you, what you write about them and their creativity and how they lived their lives, and very strong people. I'm just wondering, presumably as you were visiting some of these memories, reading your letters, meeting old friends, old surfer friends, old girlfriends, that you, we all have some kind of leafy, rosy, coloury, nicey aspects to our, how we select our memories. And there's others that we see, we talk things down that may not have been as bad as we thought, but we just kind of got a bit tricky for other emotional reasons. I'm just wondering, what did you get wrong, or what did you underestimate?
I got a lot wrong. I mean, I don't know how much in print I got wrong. I hope not too much, but because I went back and you know, did talk to people about what they remembered, and it is, you're quite right. I mean, this memoir is particularly for a reporter. I mean, it's a very weird genre. You know, you end up kind of investigating your own memories, reporting out your past, and as you say, you're really not the only interested party, right? This is private life we're talking about. So it's, you know, nothing was on the record. And now, as the writer, you're giving yourself license to depict all these friends and loved ones who, from all these unguarded shared moments, usually many years later in my case. And that's a, you know, you need to think long and hard about what to put in and what to leave out. And you need to try to get it right. And it, in my case, at least, it turns out that, you know, many of my most vivid, cherished memories were quite wrong. You know, people remember it very differently. I mean, I think that unreliability of memory has been sort of scientifically proven over and over, but still it's a shock when the memories in question are yours. You know, all those stories, as you say, that you've been telling, polishing, and improving here and there forever, just are full of myth and erasure, and I went back to old friends and a lot of negotiation over, you know, what actually happened and how should we put this, because nobody remembers things the same. And I did have letters and I kept good journals when I was young, so I had a fair amount of archival and documentary stuff to try to get it right and correct the record, but It's a big and nebulous project trying to reconstruct one's past.
was surfer, journalist and all-round hero William Finnegan, whose unputdownable book, Barbarian Days, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Biography. Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life is published by Little Brown and retails for just under €11 in paperback. Suffice to say, this is a killer memoir. Edgy, action-packed, insightful and unbelievably poetic. I bloody loved it. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thanks to Ronan Burnock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's programme with some gripping words from surfer William Finnegan, who writes in Barbarian Days. Being out in the surf is dreamlike. Terror and ecstasy ebb and flow around the edges of things, each threatening to overwhelm the dreamer. An unearthly beauty saturates an enormous arena of moving water, latent violence to real explosions and sky. I want to be nowhere else. I want to be anywhere else. I want to drift and gaze, drinking it in, except maximum vigilance. A hyper alertness to what the ocean is doing cannot be relaxed. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.